talking to my people, yeah. Talking to the ghetto, get down. You're out there floating on your own, hoping the streets will somehow occupy your mind. Dropped another life at your feet. Now that you face another day, it leaves you feeling like you'd like to take it home. Your eyes see things and say, no way. Feels like there's an enemy. Everyone who loves you, ghetto people, what are you gonna do? Tell me, do you really think that the government cares about you? No, they don't. Ghetto people, who you gonna turn to next? Who you gonna turn to? Listen to me, I'm trying to tell y'all. Ghetto people, oh yeah. Where do you wanna be? Where you wanna
tell
be?
Tell me why your life is.
Tell me, tell me.
I'm running like a rare disease.
I'm running like a rare disease. Ghetto people,
stop giving up your self-respect.
Stop it,
ghetto people.
Show some love for yourself, people. Life can take some strange turns on you. Living with the things thrown at you leaves you in the cold with a day that's not worth having. Chances are the shortfalls of greed won't ever come to feel what you need, when what you really want inside can only come from you. The day will come when all of your pride standing around looking like, what am I gonna do? You have those feelings deep inside, a strange kind of sadness you can never get used to.
Ghetto people, what are you trying to prove?
Come on, tell me, y'all.
Do you really think that the world gives a damn about you?
Hell no, it don't. Ghetto people,
who you gonna turn to?
Who you gonna turn to? Listen, people, you better take a look at yourself, yeah. Talking to my people,
but you just don't see
what you're living
at. Living
like you're living,
caught up in the make-believe,
lost in your dreams, yeah. Ghetto people,
stop giving up your self-respect.
Stop it,
y'all. Ghetto people,
talking to my people, yeah. Life can take some strange turns on you. Living with the things thrown at you leaves you in the cold with a day that's not worth having. Chances on the shortfalls of greed won't ever come to feel what you need, when what you really want inside can only come from you. Ghetto people, yeah.
What are you gonna do?
What are you gonna do?
Do you really think that?
Do you think it all? With your life,
running like a rare disease,
running like a rare disease.
Motherland Media is on the air. You are listening to African Perspectives on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. African Perspectives, where we talk about the issues of our day from an African worldview, an African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak. Having been granted permission, to our ancestors whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters and friends, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. So I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is always an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who is living, and everyone who will live in the future. We have a common ancestral root. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were other cultures as well, such as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, great civilizations that were flourishing while Europe was still in the medieval or dark age. So we pour this libation to those contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the brothers and sisters who suffered the Maafa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, uprooted out of Africa, laying a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. They are now in North America, Central America, South America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to brothers and sisters who suffered the Holocaust of enslavement, of captivity. We do not know their names, but because of them, we are here. So we honor them and their sacrifice. We say Ashe. We pour libation to those men and women who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you'll know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a slave want to do? It wants to get free. There's over 400 recorded revolts of our people fighting on the continent, throughout the Middle Passage, and this hemisphere. We resisted. We were not slaves. A slave is somebody or something that submits its will to a master, and we haven't and we will never submit. So we give honor and reverence to those men and women who fought. Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, Harriet Tubman, Nat Turner, and many, many others. We honor them. We respect them for always standing and fighting for the liberation of our people. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history has a free and proud and productive people. We say ashe. We pour this libation to the spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good community life because we don't have good family life. Conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is bad because we lack consciousness. Consciousness is more than just awareness. It's a deeper understanding of who you are culturally, historically, and the necessity to come together to produce family, which is produces good community life. So we pour this libation to the spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. We say ashe. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Hotep family, hope everything is well with you today. Hope you had a great weekend. I hope you had a chance to do all the things you wanted to do, needed to do, must do, should do, better do, can do. And you did it. And the weather was accommodating for you to do it. That's my hope and prayer. But if it wasn't, you did it anyways, because I know you. You handle your business. That's beautiful. It's a great day. Excuse me. Something's trying to jump on me, but I'm going to take care of that, because I refuse. You know what I'm saying? I refuse. This is African Perspectives, and we're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen live, you can always go to our archives on timeforanawakening.com, find the red, black, and green lion with superimposed Africa on it, and that is our logo. That is African Perspectives, and check out previous recorded programs that are dated and titled. Okay. African Perspectives every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. Tonight, Acres of Diamonds, public affairs program from 6 to 8 p.m. Right after Acres of Diamonds, Let's Buy Black 365 from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Let's Buy Black 365. Tuesdays, Dr. William Rogers, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Tuesdays. Wednesdays is Sister POC, Proof of Consciousness with Revive. Revive is from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. from 8 p.m. to 11. Excuse me, y'all. 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Wednesdays. I'm looking at something and saying something else. You know, that's stay focused, Brother Oshi. Us Lifting Us, Ulu, the Economic Development Cooperative for our people in the spirit of Ujamaa Cooperative Economics, or as we like to say, family-centered economics. And that is every Thursday at 9 p.m. with Baba Kimbizi, Baba Thurman, Baba Akima, Brother DJ, Sister Shay, Sister Nanana, all the good brothers and sisters from Us Lifting Us. And very quickly, the Ulu Cafe, got to put that plug in for the Ulu, Cafe Ulu, which is located, Cafe Ulu is open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Saturday and Sunday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's located 2036 Sylvan Road here in Atlanta, And if you'd like to call and get your order in as you just run in to pick it up, so it's all ready for you, 470-788-8124. We specialize in coffee. Coffee is our thing. And you can go to our website, CAFEULU.com, CafeUlu.com. Also, go to the Us Lifting Us website, usliftingus.com, and check out the Power Summit. Check out Ledge. Check out Brother Rice and Bees and Urban Agriculture, Brother Neri. Good information. Us lifting us. Friday, 8 p.m. If it's 8 p.m. Eastern time, it is Friday. That's right, brothers and sisters. It's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Saturday Sports Talk, 10 a.m. to 12 noon with Troy Wilmore. Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore. Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. It ain't me. It's Sister POC. It's Revive, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then Sunday evening, 7 p.m., it's time for an awakening once again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The conference coming up, we're going to have Brother Jamoke in the second hour to talk about the Republic of New Africa's conference that's going to be held in Detroit at the end of the weekend, this weekend, the 29th through the 1st. So get some details and talk about that. That's going to be great. So, and WeBuyBlack.com. Check out WeBuyBlack.com, the largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses. WeBuyBlack.com. Like I said, I met the young man in the has a kiosk in the mall, in the Greenbrier Mall here in Atlanta. Some good products that are made by us, produced by us, and sold by us. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses, and that's how it should be, as you know. That's what I advocate. Conference coming up in a few weeks, 21st Century Survival Conference, straight from Straight Black Pride and Brother Irritated Genie. The 21st Century Survival Conference, April 14th at the Shrine of the Black Madonna, dealing in three areas of spirituality, culture, and survival. Spirituality be dealt with by Oshua Kwesi, the master teacher, Brother Oshua Kwesi. He'll talk about African history and spirituality, the origins of the Bible and Quran. Culture will be dealt like my good friend, Brother Baba Mwalimu Burudi. Brother Baba Burudi will talk about warrior's character. And survival, the Irritated Genie. African survival in the 21st century. You want to check this out. Doors open at 12 noon. I'm definitely going to be there. We got to make some determinations about where we are and where we're headed into the 21st century. Once again, March Madness is really a stirring reminder of what America was founded on. Making tons of money off the labor of unpaid black people. March Madness is really a stirring reminder of what America was founded on, making tons of money off the labor of unpaid black people. And as I watched the tournament this weekend, I'm definitely cheering for Loyola, Chicago. Hope they win it all. But I'm glad Duke lost to Kansas. And I'm glad the Caucasian kid missed his shot. In fact, when he missed his shot and went to overtime, I said, they're going to win. Kansas is going to win. And I'm going to tell you why. Because I believe in the law of reciprocity. You reap what you sow. That Caucasian kid is a dirty player. He is a dirty player. Last year, he was tripping cats intentionally. I mean, he'd stick his leg out there. I mean, now you can't get away with anything. There's multiple cameras on the court at all times, pointing out players and so forth. In fact, this year, when he stuck his hip out intentionally and tripped that brother, which it could have been a regular foul, but they call it a technical foul because of his history. And so when he missed that shot, I was like, yeah, good. What goes around comes around. You know, you don't deserve to be no damn hero. Yep. Grayson Allen. And I hate Duke. I mean, I hated Duke before Grayson Allen, but, you know, I hated Duke way back when. In fact, back in the 70s, when Krzyzewski wasn't even a coach, I hated Duke. I don't know why, but I just didn't like Duke. Didn't like Kentucky either, but Kentucky had Givens on his team, left-handed. He was killing that game as a championship. I think it was 78 or 79, one or the other. Yep, had to be 78 because 79 is magic. 79 is Bird and Magic, so it had to be 78 with Kentucky and Duke in the final. Yuck. I mean, I'm telling you, like, you know, Kentucky, Duke, North Carolina, just some of those teams that are, have been winning big time for so long, I'd be like, yuck. So, I'm always mentioned, just not about March Madness, the whole NCAA. I have a deep disdain for the whole NCAA. What, in particularly the football and basketball programs where these coaches are making millions. They are making millions. When they're getting five, six, seven in football, Nick Saban is, they got for him $11 million. John Calipari for Kentucky just signed a recent contract for multi-million, tens of millions of dollars over an extended period of time. But once again, not only that, they have multiple revenue streams. They get money from the apparel companies, Nike, Reebok, Adidas, whatever. And those young men have to wear that product. They have to. Unless if they don't want to, then they won't be playing. So they have to. But then, of course, he has radio program, television program, and all kinds of other endorsements, which, of course, the players can't do none of that. And so if you've been watching the NCAA, you can see the slick commercials they have for their student athletes. They even have Jerry Rice doing a commercial. Jerry Rice is, well, you know what? I'm going to be honest with you. I don't put a lot of stock in the consciousness of athletes. Most athletes have dedicated themselves to developing, quote, developing my craft, you know, putting a lot of energy and so forth into that. Very seldom when you get a Colin Kaepernick, a conscious athlete, a Muhammad Ali, the athletes that stood with Muhammad Ali in 65 or 6, was it, when his championship was taken. And you know, and even Kareem was there. I mean, Kareem politically is kind of weak too, but hey. My point being, you know, I wish they would wake up. And, you know, because even the guys today, you know, LeBron, you know I love LeBron. I love what LeBron has done. But even LeBron, but all of them, probably the ones that had the most impact is the ones I would wish they were most conscious. But, of course, you know, in their positions, their main thing is to maintain and sustain the privilege that Caucasians have that they benefit from. They don't want to mess this system up. They love it. They benefit. Well, this system, of course, is not a democracy. It is not a democracy. I've mentioned this multiple times. It is an oligarchy. The oligarchy, which is the rich rule. I don't care how. That's what I'm saying. That's why all these people are voting. To hell with voting. Oh, boy, I know. I know that some of our people are so adamant about voting. I said something like that the other day. This guy, he looked at me like, you know, I didn't use no profanity or anything. He looked at me like I just said something that's really crazy and whack. And I said, I don't vote. No. I've never voted for a Caucasian in my life and never will. I vote for a person. If I support you and I can vote for you, because I've supported people I couldn't vote for because they were friends of mine in politics. Give them $50, $100, something like that. Ain't no, you know, just, you know, I couldn't vote for them, but I support them. But I also know the reality that where they are in this situation, in this kind of system, only thing you can do is make a dent. You will not, I repeat, you will not radically change this system and how it is run. It is not run by the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, or any independents. This system is an oligarchy. The rich run this. It might have been that way decades ago, but that has all changed. That has all changed. Study. U.S. is an oligarchy, not a democracy. This is from the BBC Echo Chambers. A review of the best commentary on and around the world. Today's must read, the U.S. dominated by a rich and powerful elite. So concludes a recent study by Princeton University professor Martin Gellens and Northwestern University's professor Benjamin Page. This is not news, you say. Perhaps, but the two professors have conducted exhaustive research to try to present data-driven support of this conclusion. Here's how they explained it. Multivariate analysis indicates that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. In English, the wealthy few move policy, while the average American has little or no power. Let me repeat that. The wealthy few move policy, while the average American, those ones who are out there voting and marching and demonstrating just like these young kids, do you think this movement is going to really drastically change the gun laws in this country? Stop it. The two professors came to this conclusion after reviewing answers to over 1,700 survey questions asked between 1981 and 2002. So that's 21 years of material to be studied, so they can come to a decent conclusion on public policy issues. They broke the responses down by income levels and then determined how often certain income levels and organized interest groups saw their policy preferences enacted. A proposed policy change with low support among economically elite Americans, and that was one out of five in favor, is adopted only about 18% of the time, they write, while proposed changes with high support, four out of five in favor, is adopted about 45% of the time. On the other hand, when the majority of citizens disagree with economic elites, and or with organized interests, they generally lose. Moreover, because of strong status quo bias built in the system, built in this political system, even when fairly large majorities of America favor policy change, they generally do not get it. They conclude, Americans do enjoy many features central to democratic governance, such as regular elections, freedom of speech, and association with a widespread, if still contested, franchise. But we believe that if public policy making is dominated by powerful business organizations and a small number of affluent Americans, then America's claims to be being a democratic society are seriously threatened. Eric Zeus, writing in Counterpunch, isn't surprised by the survey's results. American democracy is a sham. No matter how much it is pumped up by the oligarchs who run the country and who control the nation's news media, he writes, the U.S., in other words, is basically similar to Russia or most other dubious electoral democratic countries. We weren't formerly, but we clearly are now. This is the Dread Report, says Death and Taxes magazine Robin Pinchia. Maybe, she writes, America should accept their fate. Perhaps we ought to stick it up. Perhaps we ought to stick it up. Admit we have a classist society and do like England, where we have a House of Lords and a House of Commons. She writes, instead of pretending as though we all have the same kind of equal opportunity here, of course, which we don't. I've been saying this for some time. And of course, you know, you can say a whole bunch of stuff. But a lot of times, it is not what you say. It is what is done. It is what is proven. If you say something and it is backed up by evidence, physical, empirical, realistic, then it holds weight. Now, for me, a lot of times, even reading just what I just read, I just look at around me what I see on a daily basis, what I'm hearing, what I'm viewing, what I'm feeling within a society, within American society, particularly because American society, which of course is Western, which of course is European, which of course is Caucasian, dominates the world. And for me, it's a problem. It is a problem. So, you know, here's another piece. You know, my favorite place for information is AtlantaBlackStar.com. Go to AtlantaBlackStar.com for outstanding videos, video streams and narratives and all kinds of good features. This comes from one of their staff people, their brother David Love, and it is 5 big myths debunked by the New York Times report on race, economics, and gender inequality. Pretty much holding to what I just read, because in that society of oligarchs, there is no such thing as equality. They have it all. They're going to keep it all, and they'll parcel out whatever they want to keep the so-called masses appeased. Five big myths debunked by the New York Times report on economics, race, and gender inequality. The breadth and depth of and reach of systematic racism in America is something which American African people are intimately familiar, as they live the reality of discrimination every day and suffers its consequences. Yet, their experiences are often anecdotal and not data-driven. And even if they were, society tends to downplay or even dismiss their cries of injustice and urge them to stop complaining, work harder, and pull yourself up by your bootstraps. A new report from the New York Times, based on a study from researchers at Stanford, Harvard, and U.S. Census Bureau, examines race and economic opportunity in the United States, shedding light on racial disparities in income and offering suggestions as to how to overcome them. This intergenerational examination of inequality and how it changes across generations helps dispel some myths. Myth number one, it's about class, not race. And all that black people need to do is pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. You Negroes, you coloreds. If there is an American dream, that dream is working out for some but not for others. And it is based on race and ethnic group. The study examined the upward and downward mobility of 5 groups across generations: Hispanic, non-Hispanic, Caucasians, American Africans, Asians, and indigenous people, Native Americans, and their future earning trajectories. Researchers found that American Africans and Native Americans, indigenous people, children, have far higher rates of downward mobility than any other group. For example, American African children born into top centile on the economic ladder are nearly as likely to fall to the bottom income centile as they are to remain at the top. In other words, this is a matter of race, not class, as growing up in a high-income household does not provide insurance and guarantee that one will stay there because of these differences Because of these differences in economic mobility, American Africans and indigenous people are stuck in place across generations. Their positions in income distribution are unlikely to change over time without efforts to increase their rates of upward mobility, the study said. In addition, while American African children born at the bottom rung of the economic ladder have a 2.5% chance of making it to the top rung, This is the case with 10% of Caucasian children. Our percentage is 2.5. Their percentage is 10.6. Because why? It's theirs. You know, that's like when you do see Caucasians, you'd be like, yeah, this stuff is yours. I can't feel like that because you have more advantage. You've always had more advantage. According to the research, some of the widest racial gaps were found in the wealthiest communities, once again, demonstrating that race trumps class in the land of opportunity. American African boys born at the top and falling to the bottom in adult life, along with other American African men who grew up at the bottom and remain there, are part of the same phenomenon and two sides of the same coin. Both types of American African men are victims of the same social forces that are keeping them down and suppressing them and their aspirations because of what? Their culture. They are African. They are American African. Quote, their race. But of course, we know there's no such thing as race. We know that. There is no such thing as race. I'm not going to read some of the other comments. I'm just going to read the myths and what was stated. Myth number two, American African men and women experience the same income gap. Whether men or women, many American African people are struggling out there in today's society. They're struggling. They're struggling in today's society. With that said, the study concluded that the income gap between American African people and Caucasians is driven by the disparities American African men face. Among those people who come from the families with comparable incomes, American African women grew up earning slightly more than their Caucasian women with little or no wage gap, while American African men earn considerably less than than Caucasian men. That was interesting. I'll read that again. Among those people who come from families with comparable incomes, when they compared to Caucasians and us, American African women grow up to earn slightly more than Caucasian women because American African women are more educated. In fact, it was borne out from this last election, one group in a society that is getting more degrees than others, than anybody, American African women. Consider that 21% of American African men in the lowest family income group are incarcerated, higher than any other demographic. However, American African men raised in the millionaire households in the top 1% of Americans are likely to face prison as Caucasian men who grew up in homes with annual incomes of $36,000. You'll still be hunted. You'll still go to prison. While American African women and girls face great inequality on various levels, something is happening to boys as they turn into men. While American African and Caucasian boys both do better in communities in which there is low poverty, American African boys are faring worse than Caucasians in 99% of census tracts, earning less, having lower economic mobility in adulthood, despite coming from the same economic level. These results suggest differences in the way American African men experience racism, their racial stereotyping as criminals, and the school punishment and employment discrimination they face. So, you know, Caucasians don't face that. Face that is theirs. We face that no matter what income levels we come from. So it doesn't make a difference because you are earning and you are in the upper income levels and you're a child. And as you grow, you're still there. But once you come up out of there and you have to go out and face, you will face that same thing ordinarily or in a percentage. Myth number three, the Caucasian American-African gap is due to the family. While some discussions on racial inequality, income inequality, may attribute the life outcomes of American-African to our culture, problems with the American-African family structure or some innate problems with American-African ability, the data from this study dispels those racist notions. For example, as the researchers learned, there are intergenerational gaps between American-African men and Caucasian men, but not for women, making the ability argument implausible. Although there are racial gaps in test scores for men and women, as American-African men and women have lower SAT scores than their prospective counterparts, for example, American-African women have outcomes similar to Caucasian women, suggesting that standardized tests do not prove accurate measures of differences in ability, insofar as it is relevant for earnings by race, perhaps because stereotype anxiety or racial bias in tests. American-African marriage rates are much lower than those of Caucasians, meaning lower household incomes with one breadwinner in the house, which some may attribute to the financial disparities across race. However, the report found that the income gaps between American-African men and their Caucasian counterparts perhaps persist when they grow up in homes with identical family structures and same income and educational level. Because just like many people have said over time, I can't take the stuff that's on my face off. It is there. It's who I am. Now, of course, you can, if you got serious money, then you can do what Michael Jackson did. You know, you can go ahead and, you got to be kidding. Okay, there we go. Come on now. Act right now. Okay. Nothing can be done. Despite the sobering reality conveyed in this report, the results suggest there are things that can be done to alleviate the crises of income inequality and the lack of intergenerational mobility among American African people. In neighborhoods with low levels of poverty, according to the study, there are two factors which translates into better outcomes for American African men and narrowing of the economic disparities. High rates of fathers present in the neighborhood, in the community. Regardless of whether a particular American African man had his father present or whether his parents are married, but rather indicating the role of fathers as role models and their impact on social norms and low levels of racial bias by Caucasian people. The study found that American African men who move to communities with improved environmental factors, lower levels of racism, poverty, and more fathers, find themselves with less prison and a higher income. At the same time, American African men who grew up in these communities have a higher risk of downward mobility compared to Caucasian men. This shows the racial income gap is not fixed, but rather can be changed. I disagree. Because they'll always be there. And just because you live in a community, see, like here in Atlanta is a good case study, because you have that disparity here. You have American Africans who live in gated communities, subdivisions, cul-de-sacs, I mean, with beautiful homes. I'm talking about homes in the hundreds of thousands, if not close to a million, you know? And what this report is examining and saying that these disparities will persist even if the children from these homes with a high income will also feel and experience the economic inconsistencies and the economic deprivation that this society has heaped upon black people. Myth number five, the solution for bridging the racial income gap are simple and easy. Yeah, right. Okay, there. All right. Although environment provides a solution to inequality, or at least a cause, the problem with overcoming the income gap with respect to race is that few American African children are raised in areas that facilitate upward mobility, the study found. While 63% of Caucasian children are raised in neighborhoods where poverty rates are lower. Caucasian children are raised in neighborhoods with a poverty rate lower than 10% and with over half of the fathers present. This is the case for only 5% of American African children, according to the report. Further, given that American African and Caucasian boys have such dramatically different outcomes when they emerge from comparable family circumstances, the study concludes new policies are required and solutions such as cash transfers and measures to increase financial resources for the current generation will do nothing to narrow long-term racial disparities unless they impact intergenerational mobility. Policies that reduce residential segregation or enable American African and Caucasian children to attend the same schools without achieving racial integration within neighborhoods and schools would also likely leave much of the gap in place, the report stated. Initiatives whose impacts across neighborhoods and class lines and increase upward mobility specifically for American African men hold the greatest promise of narrowing this gap. Examples of measures with potential include efforts to reduce racism in the criminal justice system, initiatives to address Caucasian racial bias, mentoring programs geared towards our young men, and efforts to increase cross-racial interaction, according to report. And that's the report. That's what they say. And I'm saying, literally, there is nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do. We could say this, that, or the other, but the reality is, it is what it is. So, given that reality, I guess for me, what I'm saying consistently with this program, because what does this program promote? It promotes and perpetuates. This program is about independence. We need to be independent. We cannot depend on a society, this society, because of its history and how it was formed and who it is formed for. We can't compete with that. You've probably seen, if you have Facebook, or somebody maybe sent it to you in the email, if you got that or whatever, there's a few cartoons where they show one where they show a race, you know, and they have the Caucasian running unimpeded. He has no roadblocks. He has no detours. He has no pitfalls in his path. But for the Caucasian man and woman, they're running free. They're taking off. But for the brothers and sisters, you see them going through all kinds of hell to try to run this race. In fact, a Caucasian did one. I don't know if you've seen that one. He had a whole bunch of people, predominantly Caucasian, some brothers. And then he said, we're going to run this race, and the winner of the race will get something. Now, if you are Caucasian, take four steps ahead. If you have two-parent homes, take four. If you graduate, and each time he said something, brothers and sisters were being left behind. Basically showing that the race in itself is flawed because of the disparities in the race. So it is we don't start on the same. In fact, it's like a deep staggered start. Because within this society, it will always favor them at our expense, to our detriment. But yet we have these people who are always fighting and believing that this fight over the many centuries now and decades will ultimately bring us the equality that they argue. And there is no proof to that fact. In fact, what I've read and what I've talked about has shown that it is getting worse. When you're talking about even American Africans who have wealth or a decent income, the prospects of their children having that same is minimal. So, we have to understand that nobody is going to do for us. That's why I'm a member of Us Lifting Us. That is a solution. Pulling our reach, doing for ourselves instead, as opposed to the capitalist way of doing on your own or doing for you. I'm an entrepreneur. I got a downline making me big money. I got some workers. They're doing well. I pay them minimal. The system that we need to create within this madness benefits us collectively, not individually. Individualism is a European Caucasian desire. But being collective is an imperative for us. It is a must. It has to happen. We must embrace that. But because, you know, as a human being, you think about you. I understand that. I understand that. And no country does the idea of you being more important than anything is this country, because this country perpetuates individualism, materialism, greed, and violence. That's the European way. Individualism. I got mine. You get yours. And if you didn't get yours, that's your fault. Because this is America. It's there to get. You got to show the ingenuity. You got to, as they say, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, bull. But the bottom line is, for Africans, wherever we are, we must work together. We must come together. We must pull our resources and do for ourselves. So this idea of Us Lifting Us, or any kind of system as opposed to the capitalist system, will be a much more of a benefit collectively. Because see, I can't argue what an individual can achieve. That'd be crazy. That's ludicrous to do so. And really, I don't care. I care about us as a whole, because an individual became rich for whatever, how that happened, through entertainment, sports, whatever, or through a business venture, or through an invention or ideas, whatever. That's great. That's great. But it would be even greater if what happened with that person results in the upward mobility or the economic mobility of us as a people. And usually that doesn't happen. So, even though we love what happened with the Black Panther. It's now become the largest grossing superhero movie of all time. And that really speaks to us, because some of us have seen the movie 3, 4, 5 times. And going to show how serious we are about spending our money. So I'm quite sure Marvel Comics and Disney Studios are extremely happy. So now that $1 million, $1 million they were going to have, I think they're supposed to give it to the Boys and Girls Club to promote STEMs, the science, technology, and all that, mathematics and whatever, you know. Wow. Yeah. $1 million. And that's deep because, you know, that's $1 million still $1 million. But when you compare it to $1 billion, that's a mess. I'm not even going to go there. $100 million. So the bottom line is, brothers and sisters, all of these kind of reports are always out there. They have constantly said to you, this is what's happening to you. And yet our fight is still to try to make this happen for us. But it constantly says to us, it cannot and it will not and it will never happen for us. But yet we hold out hope. We believe. We vote. We put people in political office. We put people in political office, but yet it does nothing. Because the same things persist. We're going to take a break. We come back from the break. We're going to talk about the Republic of New Africa, its origins, its conference coming up. And what's happening with it, what Republic of New Africa is all about. So you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. I'm your host. You can join the conversation. Dial 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. You are listening to African Perspectives. We'll be right back.
And I see everything you go through.
Black woman.
I see your tears and your joy and your pain and your fears.
Black woman.
And your strength to endure all the beatings and the war.
Black woman.
That's why me respect you. And I believe in you and I see your struggle. I never fear your strength. I never say you weak. And when them fear your sense, they not go let you speak. Black woman, a black power. Black woman to the limit. I say this one's for you. Talk about your hair or your shoes or the clothes that you wear.
Black woman.
I talk about your mind. I
about your courage. I dey talk about your strength, your hopes and how you manage to achieve so much when they give you so little. Caught in the vicious cycle, the victim of every battle. Ah, black woman, no bleach your skin so. Black woman, wear your afro. You peel your skin if you go bleach so. Don't lose yourself to TV pictures. You look good in your afro. Don't lose yourself to foreign scripture. Black woman, wear your afro. Don't bleach your skin for nobody. One's for you.
Black woman.
She fight for every little thing where she get.
Black woman.
She struggle for every little thing where she be.
Black woman.
She struggle to go school, she struggle to vote.
Olufemilayo
Anikulapo.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. Tonight, Acres of Diamonds from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., public affairs programming. And then Let's Buy Black. Right after that, Let's Buy Black 365 from 8 p.m. to 9. On Tuesdays, Dr. William Rogers, Black Reality Think Tank from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. On Wednesdays, Revive with Sister PLC, 8 p.m. to 10. And then Thursdays, Us Lifting Us, ULU, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People, 9 p.m. And then Fridays, 8 p.m., it's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Saturday, Sports Talk with Brother Troy Wilmore, 10 a.m. to 12 noon. And then Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1. No, it's not me. It's Sister POC, Proof of Consciousness with Revive. And then Sunday evening, 7 p.m., we got time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. We're going to talk right now about the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, the NRA. The RA, Republic of New Africa, RA. N-A, the R-N-A. We got Brother Jamoke. Are you with me?
Yes, sir.
All right, Brother Jamoke. Infateo, how you doing today?
Blacknificent.
Right on, man. I hear you. Blacknificent. Right on. Well, you got a big event coming up. I know you're kind of like me, man. You're involved in a lot of things. I see you since I've arrived here in Atlanta almost about 4 years ago, and many of the conscious things that happen in our in the city here in Atlanta, you can find Brother Jamoke involved in it, trying to keep it keep that spirit going at Kwanzaa. Why is that escaping me right now? But there's a lot of stuff that Brother's involved in, not just the Republic of New Africa, but in Cobra and all kinds of good stuff that help raise the consciousness, and, of course, to help our people. So I'm glad to have you today. Give us an overview of what's happening with the Republic of New Africa, and you got a conference coming up this weekend in Detroit. And let's talk about that.
All right, great. Well, first of all, yes, I am involved with the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. I was just recently elected in our last election cycle in November 2017 as the first vice president. In our government, we have three vice presidents. And so I was elected as the first vice president. And also I serve as the Atlanta district rep. So the district reps participate in what's called our People Center Council. And our People Center Council is equivalent to like a Congress or Parliament. So I represent the city of Atlanta for the in our People Center Council as well. So, yeah, we are excited. You know, 1968 was a very powerful year for our people and history in the United States. On March 31st, 1968, in Detroit, Michigan, over 500 activists gathered at a what was called the Black Government Conference. And the Black Government Conference was to begin to make real the ideas that Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, and Marcus Garvey and other people have been putting out in terms of us having our own nation. What our elders realized at that time, what the organizers realized at that time, is that one of the things that's critical for having your own nation is to have your own government. So you have to identify your people, and you have to identify your territory, and you have to identify and you have to put up a government. And so that's why they birthed at this Black Government Conference what was called the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. And Republic of New Africa is the name that was chosen for the nation. Provisional government because we say that we are a nation, but we haven't totally come into our sovereign nation statehood yet. And so we say provisional government or temporary government until we actually manifest ourselves as a full-fledged nation state. So, yeah, at that conference in Detroit, you had all of the major Black nationalist formations represented. You had the Nation of Islam. You had Amiri Baraka. You had the king of the Oyotunji village in South Carolina. That was actually before he set up the village, a couple of years later, actually, in 1970. But he was there at that gathering. You had Malana Karenga, as you mentioned earlier, founder of Kwanzaa, was there. Yeah, Imam Jamil Alameen, at that time was still H-Rap Brown. You had so many Black nationalist leaders and organizations and formations and gathered together to move more seriously on this idea of having our own nation. And at that conference on March 31st, they signed Queen Mother Moore. I left out and some of the women. I just mentioned a lot of men. Let me add, Queen Mother Moore was there. Betty Shabazz was there representing her late husband, Malcolm X, at the time. And so at that conference, they laid out a Declaration of Independence, declaring ourselves independent of the jurisdiction of the United States. And over 100 people signed that Declaration of Independence. And then, like I said, from that point on, they began to focus on what is necessary to bring a government into existence. Later on, a Code of Umoja, what we call our Constitution, was created. We also have a creed and an oath and a flag and some of those other things as well. So it's some people. I was just talking to one of the activists recently asking me about the updates of it. And she was saying, you know, she's in D.C., Sister Nkechi Taifa, who was just talking about how this movement is one of the most profound movements that's happened in the United States. And many people don't know about it, and particularly younger generation aren't even familiar with it. So we have to do a much better job at letting people know about the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa and its history. It has a very powerful history. We could get into that a little bit later. Let me take a pause here and see if you have a question. But you asked me about the 50th anniversary. I guess you want me to go ahead and speak about that now?
Sure, go ahead. And
sure.
And in fact, you know, go through that and also to identify the states that the Republic of New Africa has carved out for our nation and some other information that our community and listeners are not aware of.
Sure. So the states are South Carolina. Actually, we say in our creed, we say all of the territory that we live in, which is really the whole United States. However, we say specifically we have focused in on South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, those five southern states. Obviously, because that's where we know most of our blood, sweat, and tears are most entrenched. But in addition to that, there's something known as the Black Belt counties. And these are counties actually starting from southern Virginia, coming all the way through North Carolina, South Carolina, and in some in Louisiana, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and somewhat into kind of ending in Texas. But the most Black Belt counties are in those states of Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and South Carolina. And Black Belt counties, meaning those counties that had a high percentage of African Americans, even in 1968 and even today,
right.
Many of those counties are still 60, 70, 80, 90% of people of African American descent. So we know that we have a large population
here
in the South. Mm-hmm.
That's why I disagree with the percentage of us. They say we're only 13% of this country's population. Now, I truly understand that we're not in North and South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, and so forth. I understand that, and I understand why we're not. But by the same token, I think our population is much greater than just 13% of the overall population. In fact, I would like to be the same percentages of us that were incarcerated, you know, because we're incarcerated 50%, damn near 50% of those of us. Those who are incarcerated is damn near us. And that's ridiculous, you know. Well, you know, somebody asked me when I told them about the Republic of New Africa some years ago, and they asked me, why not Florida? Well, you know, I said, I don't know. And so now I'm going to pose that question to you. Why not Florida?
That's a good question. I often wonder about that as well myself, and I think I've got a definitive answer. Again, like I said, I think they were primarily looking at those Black Belt counties geographically,
right.
and like I said, those Black Belt counties are most pronounced in, like I said, in those states,
right.
In South Carolina through Louisiana. You have a few Black Belt counties in northern Florida, like where Florida meets with Georgia.
Yeah, in Alabama.
Alabama and Georgia. Mm-hmm. And so, but yeah, so, you know, so I think that was, you know, maybe part of the thinking that, you know, there
right.
wasn't the same level of Black population in the state of Florida.
But be that as it is, you know, the NRA could have looked at Florida as well, so you can have the whole pretty much southeast part of this country, the whole southeast
right.
part of this country, you know, although
right.
let's be, you know, be real, you know, I remember going to some Republic of New Africa meetings. In fact, Baba Akima was a member who lives here, who's with Us Lifting Us. Baba Akima
right.
was with Republic of New Africa and that infamous shootout in Mississippi, which, you know, landed him in as a political prisoner.
Right.
You know, that was happening at the time. You know, and I remember some other great leaders of Baba Obadeli, you know, and who also started in Cobra, you know, Republic of New Africa. So, you know, even though I can honestly say, because I don't lie about what I've done, I've attended some meetings. I can't say that I was a member of the Black Panthers, because I attended some meetings there, as well as Republican Africa. But by the same token, as a teenager, I had some level of consciousness and understanding of who and what we are. And, of course, and that has grown over the period of time, particularly since I worked in the fire service, because the fire service is the most racist occupation that you can have. And that'll, and if you aware of that, that'll help you learn a lot of things quickly, you know. And so That's how I became more entrenched and more in love with Us, having an opportunity to read more and go to conferences, get involved in other organizations. And in fact, at one time, I didn't think that the Republic of New Africa was still in existence, because I had not heard anything from the Republic of New Africa in quite some time. I thought that they either were out of or just really dormant. But I see that in the last, 5 or 6 years, I know they have really been trying to gain membership and gain awareness of what the Republic of New Africa is about.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, a few people, I was in the airport the other day talking about the Republic of New Africa, and this elder had said a similar thing to me, too. He didn't know that Republic of New Africa was still going on. But, you know, yes, and we definitely are still vital and have continued. There definitely was a lull period in the 80s and 90s. You know, however, you know, we've consistently, you know, had elections. We've consistently been focusing on, you know, nation building, on perfecting this idea of a government, as well as I think the main issues that the main issues that the provisional government for Africa have consistently worked on basically is three. One is reparations. And so, again, like you mentioned, that NCOBRA was somewhat birthed out of the Republic of New Africa, although there were other organizations that came together. And so a lot of, at one point, some of the energy kind of shifted into NCOBRA and reparations.
Right.
A lot of the leadership of NCOBRA, the early leadership of NCOBRA, and even still to this day, you had cross leadership between NCOBRA and the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. The first male co-chair, national male co-chair of NCOBRA was Kalanji Olusegun, who was also a vice president in the Provisional Government of the Republic of Africa. And like you mentioned, Imari Obadeli, as well, who was president of the Republic of New Africa for 20 years. And I think at the time when NCOBRA was created, he was still president. Because he was, 1970 to 19.
And his wife was president too, right, of NCOBRA?
She was, Janita Scott. She was a female co-chair of NCOBRA. NCOBRA has dual leadership, so we have a male and female co-chairs.
Right.
And so, she was, Janita Scott, she was the female co-chair for a period of a time with NCOBRA as well, this is true. And then Baba Hannibal Afrique, who's also was, you know, active with the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, also with NCOBRA, was a national male co-chair of NCOBRA for a period as well.
In fact, I was at a conference in Chicago, and Baba, you know, you were the black firefighters, ain't you? I said, yes, sir, Baba. I want you to join. I want y'all group to join NCOBRA. And so I what could I say? So I went to the organization, and we joined as an organization, International Association of Black Professional Firefighters, you know, and I pressed upon them to do so, you know, through Baba Hannibal Afrique's insistence. He's a great man, all of them, Baba Obadeli, all of them, you know. Now, understanding that it is very difficult to establish sovereignty on a land here, know, because not even Caucasians have been able to do it. Like the Caucasians have been trying to go to the Northwest and take that land and to territorialize themselves off and say that they're sovereign. And the United States government, and you know, has come down on them. You know, I understand the idea, because I know the Nation of Islam, and I don't know if the Nation of Islam came up with the same thing, I guess because you were part, they were part of the initial organizing, because the Nation of Islam talked about the same thing, getting these five states in the Southeast where we can be sovereign, you know. And has anything happened, or any, aside from appealing to this government, which is, you know, rotten to its core, but has the Republic of New Africa gone outside of this government to make this appeal, i.e. Some international body, UN or whatever?
Well, you know, that's actually, it's an interesting dynamic about that. So as I understand, in order to do that, even with reparations or with, you know, with appealing for us to have a nation, is that another nation would have to bring that to the United Nations. And so we have, you know, had some challenges, and we thought with some of maybe more the progressive African nations would have taken that on. But from what I understand, they have not. We've never found a nation that will be willing to really champion that inside the United Nations. So that's one thing. Now, I guess at another level, you know, I've been doing a little bit more research on this and finding out how, you know, different formations have gotten some standing within the United Nations. So, for example, like the Palestinian Liberation Organization, you know, they have, like, I think, observer status, and they've gotten themselves on a couple of UN committees, I believe. You know, again, though, but in order for someone to, for them to really get the proper recognition, another nation would have to make the case for them, being a nation. And I don't think, you know, no one has been willing to do that at that point. So kind of a catch 22, right? You got to be a nation in order to argue, in order to raise the issue. Can I be a nation? Right. You have to have another nation to
do that,
to make that case for you. But so that's where that is. But you know, with all of these things, with reparations and with the nationhood, I think that the main thing that we don't want, we overlook, or I think, I don't know if it's intentional or not, because I think we don't want to do the work, which is we have to win the hearts and minds of our people. That's the key thing. You know, the legal aspect of it and the international aspect of it, you know, will play itself out. But the key thing, in my opinion, is that we have to really work on winning the hearts and minds of our people. And, you know, I think, like, you know, that was demonstrated, for example, with the recent referendum they had in Spain, the Catalonians.
Right.
You know, you had 80-90% of them saying that they wanted to be a separate nation.
Right.
And so now that has to be recognized. You know, you just, you know, so, you know, and there was pushback from Spain, right?
Oh, yes.
Spain just said, oh, okay, you know, we're going for that. But because of that high percentage of support, it makes it, you know, difficult for Spain not to address it. You know what I mean?
It makes
it difficult for Spain not to you know, and for the other international community not to address it as well. So that's one of the things I think also that we don't talk about enough when we talk about these strategies of reparations or strategies of nationhood, is that, you know, I would share with people, if you think about the history of any country, even the history of this country, we know that, you know, United States bought France, you know, France in to help them defeat the British. It wasn't that, you know, they were able to stand up to the British by themselves, right? So we know that many of the African nations, for example, you know, worked with the Soviet Union to overthrow the former colonial powers that was in their country, whether it was Germany or France or Spain or whatever. So, you know, we also have to begin to think strategically like that as well, and figure out what are some alliances that we would need to build to get support for our claim for a nation state as well.
Well, I would.
But first would have to be the buy-in of the people,
right?
right. You definitely got to get that first.
But see, and that's
then,
the problem.
You know,
that's the problem here in America, because our mindset is so warped and so messed up. It's hard for us to envision or even think about doing something independently of this Urugu, of this cracker. That it is very difficult to impress upon our people the right to be free, to be self-determining, to be liberated, to be sovereign. It's hard for our people to do that, you know? Because
It's true. You know, a lot of times I see the younger people, I say, you know, posting about, you know, freedom and liberation and everything. And then, you know, one of the things that I often do is I'll respond to a lot of those quotes and or those posts. And, I say that, you know, freedom and liberation is not a abstract term, you know, like you're putting forward. Freedom and liberation comes within a context. And one of the contexts it comes within is you having your own nation state. So if you're really serious about freedom and liberation beyond just speaking about it or talking about it in the abstract, then you would be serious more. You would consider being more serious about us having our own nation state.
Right.
Because that's how you get to freedom and liberation, you know.
But see, you know, that's the hard work of it. The romanticizing of it, the idealistic side of it is one thing. But the other thing, there's some of us, honestly, and I've said this a number of times, I don't believe that we can be sovereign here in this land because of how the Caucasian is. You know, when we look at things that we have done, in spite of all the evil that this person or these people have heaped upon us, particularly coming out of enslavement, when we knew we had to come together because we couldn't go to their stores, we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that, and so we closed ranks, pulled resources, and created solid, good communities that were functioning. Rosewood, Elaine, Arkansas, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and so forth, and you see what happened to them. Allentown in Los Angeles or area. You see what happened to them. A Caucasian will use whatever thing they want to justify, particularly a white woman was accosted Okay, we'll use. They always use that one. That's pretty prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
White woman was accosted. Now they're gonna vamp on our community. And even though the authorities, which were not us, because we couldn't police, we didn't have a police. We didn't have a military force. We were not allowed to have a military force to protect those communities. And so those crackers vamped on our community and destroyed them. First pillaged, stole, and then burned down and either exiled us or killed us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, if you think that mindset is gone, you're naive, because that mindset is always very prevalent. The Caucasian hasn't changed a damn bit. He's selfish and greedy and don't want to share.
Mm-hmm.
And don't want to be supportive. So that's why I've maintained that. I mean, you look at in the Allentown, they poisoned people's water. You know, in Lane, Arkansas, they were trying to organize. They were trying to organize. And they vamped on the church and just started shooting us until like almost 300 of our people were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Tulsa, Oklahoma, we know the you know that history of Black Wall Street. You know it was the first city that was bombed from the air.
Mm-hmm.
Just like mm-hmm. they did in Philadelphia, you know?
Right.
So all of this unfortunate reality, you know, that's why I feel that we can't establish some sovereignty or land of our own or some independence on this soil. I mm-hmm. mean, even the indigenous people don't really have sovereignty. Because mm-hmm. if the Caucasian sees, if the cracker sees that there's something that he wants to do, or there's something mm-hmm. on that land that he wants to take, he'll just do mm-hmm. it. Look what happened in Standing Rock.
Mm-hmm.
The Caucasians in Bismarck, South Dakota said, no, we don't want this pipeline to run to our community, possibly messing up our drinking water or our soil or whatever. And so they said, okay, fine, y'all cool. We'll just go ahead and run it through the indigenous people, the Native American people's land and their water source. And we're just going to do it. We're not going to ask them. We're not going to try to compromise. We're just going to do it. And if you remember, Brother Jamoke, what was happening to them was not even broadcast on national news. It wasn't on ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, MSNBC. It was on none of that. The only place that you've seen that, if you were keeping track of Facebook or some emails mm-hmm. here or there, you know,
right.
until finally, you know, because of what was happening to him, water cannon sprayed on him, rubber bullets and so forth. Did Barack say something and stop it? And then, of course, when Trump was elected, then the those who ran those pipelines said it's a bet, because number one, Trump was an investor.
Mm-hmm.
He was a big time investor in the pipeline. So they said, we know we're going to do it. And of course, now they've done it. You see? So, mm-hmm. I mean, we can have all of the moral things on our side, but in a society of people who are amoral, that don't work, mm-hmm. you know? We can make all the appeals we want. It's not going to work, you know, mm-hmm. at least I feel. But to me, I love the idea. I loved it when I first heard about it when I was a teenager back in the 60s, yeah. you know.
Well, I am to me as an activist, and I feel like, you know, we have to be, it was a cross between being an optimist and realist. And so, you know, I always believe in what I call the realm of possibilities. To me, you know, things are possible. I mean, likewise, you've given me all those examples. I could also give you examples where, you know, people didn't think the wall between East and West Germany was going to come down. People didn't think that, you know, there would be a Black elected president, not just a Black elected, formerly incarcerated Nelson Mandela would be elected president. Because I remember in the 80s working on Nelson Mandela's campaign and Free South Africa movement. And, you know, activists, many people thought he was just going to die in jail, as many other leaders have in South Africa. And, you know, for him to come out and become elected president. And, you know, again, I always use this. Another example, you know, 2 years before before, we could talk about the, you know, what it really means and what it don't mean. But 2 years before Barack Obama ran for office, if you had asked any African American or really anybody, would we have a, you know, black president, everybody would say, no, we're not, you know, the United States not ready for that, or da 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 da, or he'll be killed before he gets in office, or, you know, people not gonna vote for him, or whatever, whatever, whatever. And it happened. So,
right.
You know, another statistic, well, another thing, even if you don't want to deal with any of those things, that we could, you know, debate them up and down, those, you know, I could also just say that one of the things that I often share with people around, to me, the possibility, reality of it is that by their own statistics, right, they say in 2050, by 2050, that the population would be more or less 30% African-American, going back to what you were talking about, the numbers, right?
Right.
But 30% African-American, 30% Hispanic, and 30%, you know, really 20% European and 10% other, right? So at that point, the Hispanic population and African-American population is in the majority, right? And so, to me, I think I could see it would be very conceivable that we could carve out
right.
the United States and say, right, we'll take the South. You know, the Hispanic takes from Texas to California, which was already their territory anyway, yeah. right?
No, I like that. Hey, brother,
and there's
I
a whole
like
movement
that.
Called Auslan that's been, you know, in existence, I think, for some time. You know, and then the Europeans would stay in the Northeast and Midwest.
Right.
You know, and then we, and then even I've been fine-tuning this theory of mine, even say we might even have some buffer states. So states say like Kentucky and Tennessee or Arkansas might be like, you know, buffer states, you know, if you want to hang out in the multicultural state of,
right.
of whatever, as opposed to in the Republic of New Africa or Auslan.
But see, but Jamoke,
yeah.
that makes it a necessity to get Florida, because I'm quite sure all those old crackers down in Florida, they don't want to be isolated. You know, but I understand what you're saying and that sense of possibility and you're right. Although the demographers who study these demographics say that it's going to happen by 2040, which is only 22 years away.
Okay.
That these numbers will change. That's why I'm saying mm-hmm. I don't believe that our number percentage in this country is 13%. I believe it is much higher. I can't speak to
right.
how high it is. I know it ain't 30%, but in some places, particularly here in the South, and even some places in the North, in major mm-hmm. cities, you know, mm-hmm. there's a predominance of us.
Sure.
I mean, hell, in Milwaukee, where I'm from, and many of our people didn't believe that we were in Milwaukee because they watch Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley, you know, or watch a Bucks game. You know, they'll see us at the Bucks game. They see us playing on the court, but they didn't see us in the stands, and that's true. But by the
right.
same token, Milwaukee is about 40, almost 40-something percent us, you know?
Right.
And so that's to say, although Milwaukee's population has dwindled, but Milwaukee's population was around 700,000. So that's to say about 200-some thousand is us. In fact, that percentage was higher than even in other southern cities like Memphis. We had a bigger population, you know? But that was because we had migrated through those migration patterns, and now we're, you know, we're returning. Many of our people are returning. And so given that fact, Brother Jamoke, that's another plus, an idea for the Republic of New Africa, because our people are returning in numbers. So we will gain those percentages. But the problem, of course, is our people are not conscious. Our people are not mm-hmm. aware of the importance of being collective, of being independent and sovereign. Because we've been trained to rely on Caucasians for everything, you know, everything that happens for us and with us is because of what they have done and what they do. And our people rely on Caucasians for education, for jobs, for everything. You know, mm-hmm. and so that's why you said probably the most difficult thing that Republic of New Africa has in COBRA, National Black United Front. I mean, I could go on naming multiple organizations that deal with the issue of independence and self-determination and liberation and sovereignty for African people. But the fact of the matter is the majority of our people have a very Negropean mindset. You know, and that whole idea is about themselves. I got mine. Because America's about individualism, materialism, mm-hmm. greed, mm-hmm. and violence. And more of us think mm-hmm. about what's in it for me. How can I get mine? How can I get over it? In fact, when it happens, they'll say, hey, I got mine. Get yours. And if you didn't get yours, it's your fault. As opposed to understanding that the fault really lies in the system itself. This is a corrupt, evil system. You know? And that's what we really need to think. You know, these are the things that we as a people need to discuss. That's why it's important of what's going to happen at the end of this month. I know there's a conference coming up here in Atlanta on the 14th, the Survival Conference with Baba Baruti and Oshawa Kwesi. Mm-hmm. I've been mentioning this every program since I got this information about the Republic of New Africa. I mentioned all of these things. I'm going to mention Malik Zulu Shabazz conference that's coming up too at the end of around the 20th, I think it is, of April. Yeah, mm-hmm. in D.C.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to me,
yeah.
it's very important that we come together. Yeah. I know some people are always meeting, but no, we need to meet. We need to exchange ideas. We need to figure out what can work, what can't work, what has been done, what is being done, what needs to be supported, and so forth. We need that. We need to come together.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you on that. You know, I feel like this strange animal that likes meetings because I hear so many people talk so negatively about, disparagingly about, you know, meetings. And, you know, my thing is like, you know, meetings are a part of life. You know, I mean, even as crazy as President 45 is, I mean, he has to go to meetings on a regular basis to figure out what, you know, how they're going to manage this corporation. And I mean, any business that you work with, any corporation, they have meetings. Even when you're on your job or stuff, didn't you have to go to meetings when you were on your job? I know I went to meetings.
No doubt.
I'm self-employed now.
Yeah.
But I remember there was always staff meetings on a regular basis. I mean, meetings are like, it's necessary. You have to disseminate information, like you said, with each other, communicate ideas with each other and let people know what's going on, you know? And so, you know, it's always interesting to me, and I hear people talk so much against meetings. You know, y'all just talking. Well, talking is what created everything.
Exactly.
Everything I tell people started as an idea, and then it moved into a conversation, and then it moved into reality.
That's right.
So it had to be a conversation before it could even move into reality, because, you know, so.
Cause it's like
and on that note, let me share a little bit about the New African Nation Day, because I know you, and it's not really a conference, as we call it. It's New African Nation Day, just like celebrating the 4th of July. It's the day that we, you know, like I said, as I gave the history earlier, that the Declaration of Independence was signed. So every year we honor that day as our day of independence, and we call it New African Nation Day.
And
like
what
I said, this year happens to be the 50th anniversary of New African Nation Day, so we're really excited about that. And so we'll start on Thursday with doing community outreach. And one of our elders has brought to my attention over the last few years that, you know, when we go to cities for conferences or meetings or conventions, that we go in and we have our meeting, then we leave, and we don't, you know, we need to do a better job of interacting with the community and touching the community and talking to the community about what we're doing and that we're in town and what we're about. So we began to incorporate that. I've been getting to incorporate that into the organizing when I have gatherings in different cities. So we're starting out.
So when is the actual New African Nation Day? When is that?
That is actually March 31st.
March 31st. Okay. And that, and has it always been that?
Always been March 31st.
March 31st. Okay.
March 31st, 1968. And every year since then, March 31st.
50 years.
And it just so happens this year that it falls on a Saturday. But whether it falls on a Saturday or not, we always honor that particular day, March 31st.
Okay, March 31st. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to me, what's important, you go on the day of what it is.
Yes.
You know, because I know now with Juneteenth Day, you know, it's June 19th, but usually some cities will get the closest weekend to that day to have some celebrate, understand it. But Milwaukee, we've been celebrating Juneteenth Day for about 60 years.
Wow.
Well, maybe a little less than that, about 55 years, something like that. You know, on that day, on June 19th, we have a parade and a street festival on that day. But I understand what you're saying. And so to me, I didn't know it was New African Nation Day. March 31st, and it started in 1968. And this is the 50th anniversary of that. So we have some other callers, Jamoke. We got some callers to ask some questions. Let me take some callers, okay?
Okay.
Thank you, brother. 678. Go ahead, 678.
Good morning, brother. How you doing, man?
I'm doing fine. How you doing?
Good. Doing great. Doing great.
Good. You sound great.
Greetings to your guests from the New Africa Movement. I'm enjoying this. Excellent talk. Excellent discussion. Listen, I wanted to ask the brother a question. Considering the whole approach to the New Africa Movement to build a new nation and to build a nation. And to build it in terms of sovereignty and stuff. I wanted to ask him if he would comment on the idea of having an independent economic base in order to do that. And let me kind of explain a little bit what I mean. In other words, if you were going to consider isolating ourselves or to go into some type of separate kind of situation, or, you know, even just internally build a new nation where we'd be strong, we would have to have an economic base, and one that where, you know, others would have no choice but to come to us. And let me give you an example. I think about when the Dutch Amish people came to America, and they went into Pennsylvania, and basically they... A lot of things were said. They were crazy. They were dissidents. They were all kind of different stuff. But they did build themselves an economic base. They became master furniture builders. The Dutch furniture, the Amish furniture, became some of the best furniture that you could buy anywhere in the world. And so people were coming into Pennsylvania buying that furniture from the Dutch, you know, over and above all of the other companies that were operating in America selling furniture as well. So I'm thinking that if the African-American situation is going to require an independent kind of status like what the New Africa rule, don't we need to have a economic base that would be totally controlled from bottom up by the entity that has it, and that we would have to make it so that even when you have your adversaries who refuse to buy from you, they'll have no choice because the world is coming to you. And so the question then is that being considered as a part of your programming? And is that necessary? First of all, I guess I'll ask that. And then if so, is it being considered, and how would you do that, even though the fact a lot of times we don't own land where we can grow that type of a product or build that type of product because it's always owned by somebody else?
Okay. At first, it was started out as a simple question, and toward the end, you added some different dimensions. But yes, we do understand the importance of having an economic development plan, and that is definitely critical. And yes, we do have ideas around that. But I actually would like to go up one more notch than that from what you're proposing. And I remember one time I was on the radio, and I was talking about reparations, and a woman called in, and she said that, we live in a capitalist society, and we should teach our young people how to make money. And I said, well, you know, I hear what you're saying, ma'am. However, we don't make money in the United States. We earn money. There's a difference. Make money is when you print money. So as a government, we will be considering how we will be creating our own currency. Right. And we could create our own currency and put Harriet Tubman and Marcus Garvey and Martin Luther King or Sojourner Truth or whoever we choose on the currency and give it the value that we choose. Right. So that we will be, again, able to trade with our currency with Jamaica, or with Ghana, or with France or whatever. So, yes, we not only will we have to have a strong economic base, we will also be considering, creating our own currency. And so would be really independent of, the system. Mm-hmm. Okay. And there's some movements around doing that at the small grassroots level where I think we could pilot it. You know, there are certain places in the United States where people, certain neighborhoods and communities where they have created their own local currency. And, I've been, having some conversations with people around it, actually experimenting with that in Atlanta. And I know some other people that have been having that conversation as well. you know, and then from, you know, the local currencies, then, you know, it could expand out to, you know, other places, and we could ultimately, we will have our own national currency in time.
Okay, that's good. That's powerful. Mm-hmm. That's powerful. Because that really does concern me in terms of when you look back over the over time, look back in the history, that always was a factor, you know, in doing that, you know, is being able to create that independent base. So, okay, thank you, my brother. I appreciate it. Sure. Blessings to you in that movement.
Thank you, brother.
Okay. All right, thank you. Thank you, caller. You know, that's the whole idea of being independent, self-determining, liberated, and sovereign, because that's what this program is about. That's what we talk about every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, is that idea and that concept. And I know that this world is run by some very evil people. These Caucasians, and it's a small few, because you look at what Muammar Gaddafi was proposing when he developed the gold dinar to use to tell the world, this is what you're going to need because my oil is backed up by this currency. And he was going to give that to the African countries. They would have had economic independence.
That's right.
But of course, the international bankers, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and all these folks, all these Jews, no, they couldn't have it. So the United States under Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and of course, England, they said no. So the smear campaign was initiated. You seen on TV, Libyans rioting. Of course, it was not true. The Libyan people love Muammar Gaddafi, but that's what they wanted to put into your mind to justify his murder, to justify the murder, same thing with Iraq, you know? So they put that in their minds, you know? Oh, we got another call. Let's take this call, Brother Jamoke.
Okay.
602, go ahead.
Yes, Brother Oshie and Brother Jamoke. It's Brother Marcus.
Hey, Brother Marcus, how are you today?
Great,
doing great. Yes, yes, good brother. No, well, I almost remember, you know, that Garvey had a saying. He said, Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. So by us joining together economically, okay, we could, we here, the black people here in America, could market a lot of those products coming out of Africa. What's happening now is that the European and the other people are there in Africa and they're buying direct from the Africa, you see, and they're getting peanuts for their products, you see, because we are not there, you see. But if we were there joined with them, they would have to come through us here to buy in America. See, you want to buy anything in Africa, you got to come through us. See, so we'll be their eyes here, and they'll be our eyes in America, I mean, in Africa. But being that we're not connected, you see, it's causing all these, you know, all these economic problems, you see, because all that cobalt, all that coltan, they would have to buy it from us. You want to buy anything in Africa, you come through us here.
And,
you see? And in that way, we lift each other up economically.
And get a fair price for the all the mineral resources, whatever products there, to get a fair price. Because, see, you know, my logo that I used to have before I came on to Time for an Awakening, I was on Blog Talk, and that was a logo that shows that Africa is not poor. Africa is being looted, you know, and it showed Africa being, you know, with these pipes in it and all of its resources are being siphoned off to here, to Europe, to America, and so forth, you know. And of course, these makers, whatever products they are, whether it's electronics through the Japanese or the Chinese or the Koreans or whoever, have relied on the mineral resources, getting them cheaply coming out of Africa to develop their products to be sold globally and sometimes at a very expensive price. I mean, if you go to some of these stores, man, these prices are high.
Exactly. So we have to re-examine that. And because we must remember, it is not America, it's not the prize. It's Africa. for black people. It's not America, because the red man here, he wants his land back, you know. You see, he's not dead. These people ain't dead, you know. And by us stating a claim to here, we are depriving the red man of his legacy and his birthright, you know, because his Africa is our prize, you see. So anyway, good brother, you keep on doing what you're doing.
All right, my brother. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus. Appreciate you. Have a good day.
Yeah. And I just wanted to add a little bit to that. I agree with the brother. However, we also know that people of African descent were here in the United States, and some would say even before what we call, quote unquote, the red man, you know, and there's evidence of that in terms of the mound building and the pyramid building, or they call it mound building, that was going
right.
on in
the Southwest
thousands
right.
of years. So yeah. we, you know, we understand that, yes, and we have also partnered with those Native Americans, you know, around our nation as well. You know, we've had conversations with the Choctaw and Chickasaw Creek, Muskogee, and other ones as well. So it is important. But also, I just wanted to add this too. On another note, you know, something that you said, I remember hearing Dr. Leonard Jeffrey speak a couple of years ago, and he was saying, and he had said that he had gone to a meeting in Africa, and they mentioned that the GDP of the whole of all of the African nations was something like 500 million at that time, 500 billion at that time. And, you know, he said he looked to some of the other people that were with him. I think James Smalls or some other scholars that were with him from America, and they kind of looked at each other, because at that time, you know, the wealth, they say, of GNP of the people of African descent in the United States was like, you know, 800, 900 billion dollars, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that, you know, the partnership that we could bring to bear, not only just being an intermediary, but just the partnership we could bring to bear in terms of being purchasers of the products and services and products coming out of Africa is tremendous, a right. tremendous potential that we have
right.
With the wealth that we have in this country, which is now, they say, over whatever it is, 1.2 trillion now, whatever it is. And so, you know, yeah, the brother brings up some interesting points in terms of, you know, the importance of us linking with Africa definitely is critical.
No, it's
financially
right.
linking up with
right.
Africa, we should emphasize.
Mm. Right. Because, you know, they're on the continent, there are some fast growing economies. But mm-hmm. if it's not coordinated the way it should be, you know, because this is what's happening. I look at, we need to get African people to believe in Africa. Mm-hmm. You have African people trying their best to go to Europe or anywhere else, mm-hmm. you know, to come here. And yeah. I understand that because of colonization and the impoverishment, they want a better situation. But mm-hmm. I look at it in reverse. I think that us as Africans in the diaspora, particularly the Africans here in America, who are the most technologically advanced Africans on the planet in whole.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. what if those Africans on the continent and the Africans throughout the diaspora linked together, which, of course, that is something that not just Europeans, but really the world does not want to happen, because now China, Korea, India, all of them, Europe, will have to deal with us forthrightly. But as long as we stay fragmented and divided, then the wealth of Africa will continually be siphoned off. And in fact, you have Chinese, Brother Jamoke, you have Chinese men who are marrying Ugandan women so they can make their claim to African land and resources. Because there are no... See, what's interesting... You know, Africa has more resources than any other continent on the planet.
Right.
Africa has more diamonds, gold, bauxite, plutonium, uranium, you name it, it has it. And yet, the image of Africa and the image of Africans is so despised and disrespected and degraded, you know, around the world. Malcolm said it best. He said, the Africans will always be disrespected until Africa is in control by Africans. Once Africa is in control by Africans, us, because we have just as much right to help liberate Africa as the brothers on the continent, brothers and sisters on the continent, you know? Mm-hmm. And once that happens, then wherever we are, here, Europe, China, wherever, we'll have the respect because our homeland is under our control. We control our resources. We are a respected people because we're self-respecting. We're self-defining. But until that happens, we will always be relegated to the bottom. We'll always be disrespected. And you look at around the world, that's the situation, you know? So, you know, I appreciate, you know, what the Republic of New Africa has done and other organizations to bring the attention and particularly to look at finding ways that we can, you know, control our situation as opposed to somebody else controlling it. And I think that's vitally important to control our situation, you know?
Yeah. To me, I mean, either us having our own nation and or going back to Africa is like the only real solution to our situation. But even with the going back to Africa and even with our own nation, we still have to confront this, you know, these peoples.
Right.
At least we'll be able to do it from more of a position of strength and power.
Right.
Than we are currently.
Right. Because we got to do it from within. We got to purge ourselves of the ignorance, the superstition, all the BS. We got to, you know, I often say that the Europeans have placed a vice grip on our minds. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you, you know, and you, of course, you know that too. Once you clamp that vice grip, you just can't pull it apart. You know, it's on there, it's tight, you know, but there's that knob at the end of the handle. And the turning of that knob to release the tension is symbolic of us acquiring knowledge of self, you know, consciousness and so forth. And the more mm-hmm. you turn it, the more information you have about yourself until finally you can release the vice grip and look at the cracker for who and what he is. Not that you challenge to change him because there's nothing we can do about them. But now you work with one another, you know, to support and be with one another. And that's what the deal is. See, that's why I'm saying that this revolution that we need is a revolution of the mind. We got to get our minds right.
Yes, sir.
You know, and take control of that, because as long as we're in this state of mind that we're in, anything that we propose, particularly for us, won't work because the cracker mm-hmm. has that vice grip on our minds, and the fear, Brother Jumoke, mm-hmm. that he puts into our people makes us not want to know. You know, in fact, there's that piece in Henry Bear, the Virginia House of Representatives, said, "We have closed off," he said this in the late 1700s into the early 1800s, somewhere in that time. He said, "We have closed off every avenue by which light may enter the captive's mind. And if we could extinguish the capacity to see the light, they will be as the beasts of the fields and we will be safe." He says, "We have closed off every avenue by which knowledge of self." But more importantly, if we can make you reject those who bring you knowledge, if you can, you know, then I know we got you. And that's what's happening. There's still today, many of our people don't want to hear about what we're talking about. They can give less than a rat's, you know what I'm saying? Because we believe of what this cracker has told us and not seeing and understanding what he has done to us and what he continues to do to us. We keep holding out hope. We continue to believe that voting will do it. All of this madness. Brother right. Jumoke, give me some closing words. I'm about to close out.
Yeah, I was hoping to go through the schedule real quick, but I don't know if we had that much time now. But so Friday, we will have a tour sure. of Detroit where we'll focus on the Black nationalist history of Detroit. And then Friday evening, we're going to have a New African Women's Symposium. And then Saturday, which is the main day, we have opening ceremonies. We'll have solidarity statements from different organizations and formations. And then the afternoon, we'll have a series of workshops, one on the Provisional Government of the Republic of Africa, one on reparations and political prisoners, one on spirituality and culture, and another one on Ujamaa economic development.
Right on.
And then the Saturday afternoon is the main program where we will have reflections from the elders, some of the elders that were actually there at the first meeting in 1968. We have one of the brothers who was the 99th signer of that Declaration of Independence, General Rashid, one of our esteemed elders, as well as other people who were there in the early years in the founding of the Republic of New Africa. We will be honoring them and having them share their stories with us. And then we'll also have the current officers to share what's happening with the Republic of New Africa now. And then we'll have some of the second generation youth whose parents were involved in Republic of New Africa, who are also activists now themselves or in the movement now, sharing with us where they think the vision of Republic of New Africa could be or should be, where we need to be going. And then, that's Saturday. And then Sunday we'll have a sort of like a think tank on Sunday from 12 to 3. And that will be sort of like just a critical analysis of, the strengths and weaknesses of the Republic of New Africa, again, trying to chart out where we need to go for the next future 50 years. So, and those main activities on Friday and Saturday will be at the Charles Wright Museum, which is the premier museum in Detroit. It used to be the largest museum before they built the Smithsonian. So we're very glad to be able to partner with that museum and have the event there. And then we'll also have some activities at Timbuktu Academy, which is a charter school there, Afrocentric charter school there, and also a Kibalan village, which is a whole lot of things, but it's sort of like a community center, cultural community center there in Detroit. And right. So that's where the activity will be on Sunday.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, my brother, thank you. When you come back.
It wouldn't be right if we wouldn't say with our slogan, we got to close out. Free the land. Free the land. By any means necessary.
I say, Brother Chimoke, when you get back, I'll give you a buzz and we can come back on and talk about the attendance and how things went, okay?
Very great.
All right, brother. We end this program like we end all our programs. The words of Stephen Biko, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind, but not just the MIND, but the MINE, because we stand on the land of resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, have a blessed and wonderful day. Hotep.
Hotep. Thank you.